A very warm good evening to everyone. I trust you've all had a wonderful day here in the Bhaktivedanta Manor, and you've experienced many interesting things. You've learned many nice things as well. And today's final program, it's the last program, right? It's going to be a talk on the topic the journey of the soul, and it's one really exciting journey that we've been through, and we have to decide our future journey. This is a journey quite like, unlike any other that we've experienced in our memory, recent memory, because it takes us through such a wide variety of experiences and situations and locations that is unimaginable for us to even think of it right now. Imagine you're traveling the world. Where would you go? What kind of extremes would you travel to? Maybe the North Pole, the Sahara Desert, maybe go to Hawaii, see the temperate climates, the tropical climates, go to the different countries of the world, go under the sea, look at the life under the sea, maybe go in the mountains and see how everybody lives there. But here we're talking of a journey that's gone far beyond that. We're talking of the journey of the soul. You know, one of the issues with human beings is that we are obsessed with the present. We think the present is the all in all. We think of the present as something that's all that exists, and that's the most important thing for us. But the present isn't all in all. It's not everything. As an extension of this idea of the present being everything, we also think of the present life being the all in all. Even though many people have some intuitive understanding of something called a previous life and the next life, but it's a very vague, unsubstantiated notion. It's not very clear. So this idea that the present is everything, and by extension the present life is the only life we've had, is something that's a conception that's prevalent very widely. What to speak of having some misconceptions about the present life? People generally do not understand the word even life. What to speak of present life? So I'll ask you a question. How do you define life? What is life? I mean, don't give me the answer like life is happiness and some distress, some happiness, or life is music or something like that. But I'm asking a question that's very philosophical, very pointed. What is life according to you? What constitutes life? Any guesses?
School.
Sorry?
School.
Life is school.
Where we learn how to be better and make mistakes sometimes.
All right. My question is, however, what is life? L-I-F-E. What is life? Because it's going to be very important for us to know the answer to this question before we know what kind of journey we've been on for a long, long time.
It's a spark of the divine.
A spark of the divine. Excellent. You're one step ahead of me. Excellent. Any further ideas? What is life?
Consciousness.
Okay, you're two steps ahead of me. Generally, even law. Any lawyers here? Now, law in different countries, it's interesting the way they define death. They say one of the definitions of death is the absence of life, or the end of life. But they don't define what life is. So when you say death is the end of something, but you don't define that something, then you haven't defined death. So you talk of death in terms of some symptoms, like irreversible changes in the lungs, respiratory system, or in the brain, or something like that. But we haven't really pinned it down. And the definition to death is not about death is not clear, because the definition of life is not clear. And how do they define life? Believe it or not, one of the legal dictionaries I checked in and Googled before I came here just a few minutes ago, they say that life is the condition of being alive. How does that sound? A tautology. What is a tautology? Yes, the very word exists in its definition. It doesn't make sense. What is the meaning of stealing? It means to steal. It doesn't really, it's not very illuminating. So when you say that life is a condition of being alive, it's not being very helpful. Or when you say life is being animate, it means the same thing. Or one step further, they may describe life as according to its symptoms. They talk of how a life is the condition in which one performs one's ordinary or natural functions. And that's a symptom. The ability to move, to speak, to think, to digest food or whatever. These are symptoms of life. So very often we confuse a thing with its symptoms. The symptoms are not the thing. Symptoms are a result of the thing. So in this way there's confusion about what life really is. Today generally, if you talk to scientists, they would describe life in terms of some chemicals, or ultimately in terms of atoms and molecules. And that's what life boils down to according to modern thinking. But that's not very satisfactory, is it? You know, intuitively also we have an understanding that life is something more than just a combination of chemicals and atoms and molecules. When somebody dies, we say he has passed away. Who has passed away? The person is still there, still lying here. So who or what has passed away? That's the question. Life has passed away. Life has ebbed away. But what is that life that has left and gone? This is a very fundamental point that's missing in modern knowledge, in modern understanding. And unfortunately, no faculty or department in any university teaches this knowledge. And even if you go to a department of philosophy or religion, they will teach it in an academic way to say, well, this philosophy believes that there is something called such and such, there is soul or something like that. But they don't actually teach it from the point of view of conviction and understanding, the same way as they would teach that there is an atom or a molecule with conviction. Because whoever teaches that there are electrons and protons and there are chemicals, they're convinced about it and they speak like that. But the understanding of life and the soul and so on are not commonly found. In Bhagavad Gita, the great book of ancient wisdom, there is a very clear understanding of what life is. Life is the soul. Now the word soul is again something very hazy, because everybody talks about soul. You know, we talk of music being my soul, but that's just a kind of a metaphorical or vague way of saying things. But specifically, what exactly is the soul? So the soul is a particle of spiritual energy. It's not material. You could say it's anti-material. It's a particle of spiritual energy that resides within the body, in the region of the heart. It is imperishable, indestructible, eternal. It is conscious, it is full of bliss and full of knowledge. Presently, however, the soul lies asleep, so to speak. It lies dormant. It lies unaware of its own divine condition and situation. So the soul presently is here, is covered over, and is driving this body. So the soul is like a driver, and the body is like a car, which is being driven by the soul or the driver. Even if the car is in good condition, if the driver doesn't sit in the car won't move. So similarly, even if the body is in good condition, if the soul doesn't exist inside the body cannot function. So the point of time when the soul permanently leaves the body is called death. Very simple. So Bhagavad Gita makes things so simple. It's just the particle of spiritual energy. And that particle of spiritual energy is the real you and the real me. So I am the soul. You are the soul. We are all souls. And we are in this human body at this time. I think you've heard this quote many times before. I think it was Mark Twain or somebody. You know that quote?
Be not spiritual.
Yes. Can you say that?
We're not spiritual beings having a human experience.
Mm-hmm.
We're spiritual beings having a human experience.
Change a little bit. We are not human beings having a spiritual experience, but we are spiritual beings having a human experience. Which means, as souls, we are presently experiencing human life. What does that imply? It implies that there was a time when we did not experience human life. In other words, it means that we, the souls, were in different bodies before this human body. And the body we were in before this particular body may have been a human body or may not. And then there was a body before that, and before that, and before that, and before that, going back to time immemorial. And unless we do something about it, which is authorized and correct, we will continue on this journey. So the journey of the soul is the journey of the soul from one body to another, to another, to another. An impractically interminable chain of bodies, one after the other, one after the other. And only a few of these bodies being human bodies. Just imagine the sheer scale, the enormity, the magnitude of this. We are talking of a time scale of millions and trillions and trillions and trillions of years. We are talking of numbers of bodies that are trillions and trillions. We are talking of every single species of life. We've been there, done that. We've been in every species of life. This is real evolution, not the Darwinian concept of evolution. You've all heard of Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin, when he speaks of evolution, he speaks about the body having evolved from that of an ape-like creature to that of humans. But the scriptures don't accept that argument, because all the bodies are simultaneously existing. So what we're speaking of is the movement of the soul through different bodies which simultaneously exist. In other words, we were sometimes in bacteria, in bodies of bacteria, sometimes germs, sometimes cockroaches, rats, mice, cats, dogs, monkeys, tigers, lions, birds, plants, trees, shrubs, living entities in the higher planets of this universe. We've been through all of these. Can we show a few pictures just to illustrate that? Not the previous ones, yeah. This goes to show how the soul transmigrates or moves from body to body, body to body, going through all the different species of life. Vedic scriptures speak about so many different kinds of species. 8.4 million types of species. And in each species there are innumerable living entities. So the soul moves in through one body, you know, from childhood to youth to old age, and then there's death, and then again it repeats, and we go through these different species of life. All over we've been through it, and that's been our story in this material world. Can we have another picture? Okay, the same story that's been repeated. Where we've been through all of these experiences, but we've forgotten that. Can we come back to the first one that you had? And this shows the movement through our particular body. The soul is journeying even presently. Because when we were born, we had a body something like this. Yes? And now we're probably something like maybe this or this or whatever. But it's changing. Do you know that since you stepped into this room, your body has changed? Yes, some cells have died. Some cells have been born. And especially depending on how old you are, there's changes going on in the body. So there's a change. So it's said that every 7 years, all the cells in your body have completely changed. So to speak, you have a new body. The body has completely been transformed. And that's, so even in this life, the soul is undergoing a journey, changing bodies from birth to childhood to youth to middle age to old age and finally death. And then onwards to another life in some other species or perhaps the same species, and the story repeats, birth, childhood, youth, middle age, old age, death. And it goes on and on and on. This is this phenomenal journey of the soul going on for these trillions of years. How does it sound? Mind-boggling? Yes? That's what we've been doing. All these years, millions and millions of years, that's all we've been doing. What have we achieved? Not really much. Whatever we achieve, we had to leave behind and go on to the next body. And this has been going on from time immemorial. And how do we select the next body? Srila Prabhupada, our founder, who translated many of the Vedic texts like the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam into English, he gave a very simple explanation. And I'll adapt that explanation for all of you living in England here. Let's say you're just starting out on life and you don't have much money. So you get a studio apartment on rent because that's the cheapest. And then you start working and you earn some money. And you have enough money to put a down payment, and then you get a loan or a mortgage, and then you get another house, which is bigger than this one. And then as you go on, you start your business and you make a lot of money. Now, I'm not making any promises, I'm just giving an example. And then you make a lot of money. And then you decide, no, I want to shift to another locality, another region, which is much better. You go there. And then you said, yeah, actually this house is small, I want a bigger house. And then you earn more money. And then you get a nice palatial house. is all yours. And it's all paid up because you made a killing in the stock market or whatever it is. And you made so much money. So you got your house. And then one day, what happens? The stock market collapses. And you lose everything. You mortgage your house. Your house is gone. And you're back where you started in the studio apartment. And then you're still looking for some work. Because this business is gone. Now you start again struggling. You may have the same luck or you may not. And then you struggle again and the story begins. So in the same way, the house that you are in is like the body. So you are like the soul in this example, and the house is like the body. So just as you move from house to house, depending on what? What does it depend on? Which kind of house you move from one to the other?
Action.
Beg your pardon?
Action.
Yeah, when you leave one house to get another house, you've got a studio apartment, and then you go to a one-bedroom apartment.
How much money?
That's it. It's money. If you have money, you get a bigger house. And when you go from the one-bedroom house to a two-bedroom house, then what do you need?
Money.
You go to a better locality and get a bigger house. What do you need more? More money. So money is the criterion. Money is honey, right? No, it ain't. But you need money to get a house. So similarly, just as money is the eligibility criterion for you to get a certain kind of house, similarly the actions you perform in the human form of life, technically called karma, is your eligibility to get your next body. Depending on how much money you have, you can get another house. Depending on the kind of actions you perform, you will get the next body awarded to you by the laws of nature. This is the way how things happen. And we move on. And we purchase, so to speak, the next body by our karma. And the karma is in our hands. What kind of actions do we want to perform? And according to that, we would be obliged to go to a lower category of a house, from a palatial cottage to maybe a studio apartment, or maybe from a studio apartment to a big palace. It all depends on the money, which means the karma. So that's what is important. And what's further important is that the karma has to be performed in the human form of life. And then once you're in the human form of life, your karma acts back and forth, back and forth. You perform actions and there will be reactions. Those reactions will come in course of time. But then what happens? There is death. When death comes, it interrupts the chain of karma, of action and reaction. So then you take birth again according to your karma. And the leftover karmic reactions will come to you now. So even if somebody is a human being and gets born as a dog, for example, because of having performed some dog-like karma, then that dog may be entitled or may receive some very lavish hospitality in the house of his owner. So therefore we see many people who are rich, or even not so rich, they keep pets and they dote on them. They let them sleep on their own beds, on very soft cushioned beds. They take them to beauty parlors. They give them the best of dog food. They look after them nicely. In fact, the condition of some dogs, just from this point of view, is much better than many human beings in many parts of the world who don't have food to eat. So on one hand you have a dog, but on the other hand, you know, his physical condition, his comfort level is far more than that of many human beings. So that's how karma acts. Very complicated. depending on your complex mix of good and bad karma, you know, you get a certain body and you get a certain situation in life of happiness and distress, comfort and discomfort in that life. In this way, we move on and on, and this is carried forward, life to life to life to life to life. So we carry forward some karma, and we extinguish that by enjoying or suffering the reactions. But in the meanwhile, we're generating more karma, and that generates more reactions, and we have to take birth again, and again, and again. And so the cycle goes on. When you write sentences, you write a composition or a paragraph, you punctuate, you use punctuations, you use a full stop, you use commas. So also in this journey, in this narration, death is like a major punctuation point. It's like a full stop. Sleep at night is like a comma. The same sentence continues. Because you wake up in the morning, you remember where I was. Oh, what am I supposed to do? Who am I? But when you're asleep, you don't remember who you were, what your work is, nothing. But you wake up. So it's only a comma. But death is a full stop. So you don't remember who you were in your previous life. So death makes us forget where we were and what we were. And we wake up to a completely new condition of life. And because we don't remember what we were in the previous life, we think it doesn't exist. But logically, that doesn't stand to reason. Because we understand that we're all born in diverse conditions of life. Can you give some logical arguments for why we should think that there is something like a previous life? How many of you believe that there is something called a previous life? Okay, quite a few of you. How many have no confirmed opinion about it? Or you're in the can't say category? How many? Okay, well, how many are in the confirmed category? Yes, it does exist. How many? One, two, okay. So, can you give some reasons, logically? We're talking of simple logic. Can you give us some logic of why we should understand that there is something called a previous life, and therefore that there will be a future life? Anyone? Yes.
For me, it's the notion that this life has a purpose.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so your point is that this life has a purpose and it's a continuation of something from the previous life. That's a good point. Something more? Yeah.
For me, sometimes I felt that it's like I'm being destined to do certain things. I don't, at that particular moment, perhaps understand with my brain why. But I just sometimes feel that a deeper purpose is coming from before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I can explain it clearly, like, because like, just give one example, when somebody asked me, why did you go to yourself and when on a yoga journey? And at that time I was only 14, I didn't know, I just felt. There was not a literature for me at that time where I was living or classes. I just felt I just need to follow it. I couldn't explain it why. And then I spoke to somebody years after. I said, maybe it's something also coming from that previous.
Mm. So your answer, if I understand right, is there is an intuitive sense that we all have that we're coming from somewhere. That it didn't just start out of nothing. It's not just the beginning out of nowhere. So there is a history to our birth, to our existence in this life. There is a background to it. We have some intuitive sense. So what both of you have said is more or less like that. That intuitively we can understand there is a purpose, there is some connection. That's very nice. Something else? Yes.
The feeling of deja vu.
Excellent. Can you say what that is? What's deja vu?
The feeling like you've been somewhere or you're doing something and you think, I've been here before, I've done this before.
Mm.
That kind of thing.
Many of us may have at least once, if not more often, been through an experience when we go to a place we haven't been to in this life, and we suddenly feel an overwhelming sense of, or the idea that I have been here before, I was here before. You can't logically explain that. So that's a point that explains that yes, you indeed were, but not in this life, maybe in a previous life. I remember Srila Prabhupada once made a comment. In one of his commentaries, he mentioned, even in dreams, we can get an indication of a previous life. For example, he says, suppose you dream that you're flying. Now, in this life, you were never flying. As a human being, you don't fly. But maybe nowadays you do, what's it called? Paradiving or something like that, yes? But let's say you were never a paradiver. You did parachute or something, and so where do you think, where does that come from? So he says it's because it's coming from a previous life. Hmm? Maybe in one of your earlier lives you were a bird. So that experience of flying is there, it's stored in the mind. The mind is a storehouse of our memories for all the lives that we've been through, millions and zillions of lives. But it's all mixed up. You can imagine how many memories there must be, unlimited. But just like sometimes there's fermentation in the water and it rises up as bubbles, pop, 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 it bursts, then goes up. So sometimes randomly some of these things come up to the top, pop, they burst up, and you dream, I'm flying. No connection. But it's something coming up from your deeper, innermost subconscious mind. And giving an indication that at one time you were a bird. Srila Prabhupada also mentions, sometimes you may dream of a gold mountain, a mountain made of gold. It means you've seen gold, you've also seen a mountain. So you put these two things together and you dream of a golden mountain. So therefore our dreams and even deja vu-like experiences give us an understanding that there is something that existed in the past. We did exist before. Birth is not the beginning. Hmm? Good, excellent. Any other points? Yes?
Out-of-body experience.
You have personal experience of it?
Not myself, but my father had one before he died.
Okay. So your point is that your father had memory of his previous life. Now one can't argue much against that. That's a powerful argument. You know, I say this often. Many years ago I was giving a lecture on reincarnation. And one gentleman came up to me and said, you know, I found your lecture very boring. So I said, well, I'm sorry, maybe I'll try to make it interesting next time. He said, no, it was nice. But I found it boring because you were taking pains to explain, you know, the proof of reincarnation and this example and that example. But I remember my previous life. And that was the first time I met anyone who remembered his previous life. So I said, what? He was in his mid-50s at that time. And he said, my memories are beginning to fade. But when I was much younger, I had these very clear memories of what I was before, where I lived, etc., etc. So, yes, you can't argue much against personal experience. So, I know several people who remember their previous lives. It's not necessarily a good thing because it can trouble the mind. But nevertheless, the point is that this is a powerful argument for believing that something has existed before our birth. What else? Yes?
I think the notion of why do bad things happen to good people?
Mm-hmm.
Why am I in such a fortunate position here when I know across the globe there are people that aren't as fortunate, but still, you know, it doesn't seem fair that why them and not me, and why me and not them?
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Why? In other words, your point is, why are people born differently abled?
Mm-hmm.
Yes? Why am I not a Beethoven? I don't like it. Yes? Or why am I not like, let's say, you know, if you want to be a football star, I don't suggest you do, but in case you do, why am I not like, who's a big Beckham? Right? Like Beckham or something. Well, Beckham is Beckham and you are you. Well, you know, that's the way it is. So practice and hard work is important, but it can achieve only so much. Unless you have that underlying talent, that basic ability, no amount of hard work and practice can get you up there to be a gold medalist, athlete, or whatever it is. So why is someone endowed with that enormous talent from birth? And why is somebody not endowed with that talent? Why is someone endowed with one talent but not another talent? Why is someone born, let's say, mentally challenged, and someone born with a very high IQ? Why is someone born very beautiful and someone born not beautiful? Why is someone born in a wealthy family where he or she will never have any anxiety about where the next meal will come from? And why is someone else born in a family where the next meal is a big struggle? Why do these things happen? What has that child done to be in that situation, whatever that situation may be? And if this remains one of the most perplexing problems that have consumed the minds of philosophers and scientists over the centuries. But the Bhagavad Gita gives us such a simple answer. It's so logical. We are what we are at birth because of what we were at death in the previous life. So life is a continuum. And every birth we have is just one phase of that continuum. And that continuum is punctuated by every now and then by death. That's how it is. And that's our journey, moving on and on and on and on and on and on and on.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Isn't it a little bit like placing a guilt and responsibility of the person that they may feel that, oh, I was born not very able, whatever that able is, because it's my fault, because I must have done something before, and it just maybe doesn't feel very well, very good.
Okay, so your question is that if I were to think, for example, that I can't do a particular activity that well because I don't have the basic ability to do it, and that's because of something I did in the previous life, it doesn't make us feel good, right?
It's like I'm thinking about more serious stuff, like a person gets a cancer and may think, oh, what have I done? Is it my fault? Did I do perhaps something before or now? How did I brought down myself or any other, like, quite bad things?
Mm.
And sometimes then I feel, well, is that correct? Because some people maybe didn't do nothing, they maybe did everything correctly.
Okay, so your question is that suppose there's someone who has cancer, and should that person think that I've got cancer because of something I've done in my previous life or in this life? Yes. You see, there are two things. One is sentiment, feeling, etc. The other is philosophy. It is reality or truth. Now, both are important. So when someone has cancer, for example, we would go out of our way to offer any kind of help to that person, medically, or perhaps if you're in a position to financially, or in terms of any other, giving companionship, and so on and so forth. All forms of support, assistance, and empathy, etc. We would never go and tell that person, oh, you have cancer because of some karma, from the previous life or this life. So at that level we extend all empathy. But philosophy is something we must deal with as human beings. Truth doesn't recognize sentiment. You know, the laws of nature don't have emotions. We do, but the laws don't. You know, when you're speeding, the camera doesn't say, oh, poor so-and-so, you know, I won't send a ticket. It automatically just clicks and you get it in the mail and that's it. If a little child touches a fire, the fire will not think, oh, poor thing, it's only a little child, I shouldn't burn it. Burn. So while we deal with people on a platform of empathy, but at the back of our minds, which intellectually we should know what is what. So there is some reason, we don't know what that reason is. It could also be well coming from all sorts of pollutants and some, you know, chemicals we take in our food and maybe some unhealthy lifestyles like eating, you know, whatever it may be. So there could be any number of reasons and we probably can't find out. But there is some reason. Nothing happens by chance. That's a very important point to consider, that nothing happens by chance. So we must distinguish between sentiment and reality and keep both in their proper place. Neither rejecting neither one nor the other, but accepting both. Okay? So in this way, the journey of life goes on and on and on. And the question arises, now it's going on and on. What's the next question we're going to ask? What happens? Yes? What happens next? It just goes on and on and on, infinitely? Well, we have a choice. We have a choice to terminate this journey here and now. You have a question?
I just wanted to say something about karma. Well.
Yes, please, go ahead.
This interpretation of karma is about blame. It's a very Western idea of cause and effect. You've done something wrong and you're blamed for that. But the idea that karma is, it's not that you're being blamed, it's something you have to understand. For instance, when my friend got cancer, I said to her, this cancer could be the thing that creates your whole life journey. Mm. You could become a yoga teacher, you could become a nutritionist. It could be your whole purpose for being here. And it's not because you've been a bad person. And I think that's how I, you know, I think a slight misunderstanding of karma, that if you're doing the wrong things, so you're going to get the wrong things back.
Sometimes it is interpreted like that by the Western world.
But actually, indeed, to some degree, it is like that. Because, you know, what does the law of karma say? The law of karma says that when you perform certain actions, there will be reactions. Actions that are classified in the category of good actions, materially, will bring reactions on the material platform that are good. Actions that are bad on the material platform will bring reactions that are bad. By bad we mean things like suffering, pain, dishonor, discomfort, inadequacies, and so on. So yes, indeed, it is a fact. It is a fact. The problem, however, is when people disregard the sentiment or the emotion aspect of it and just deal with the philosophy. Or people just deal with the sentiment and forget the philosophy. So we have to have that balanced approach of seeing both.
But karmically, for instance, my grandmother, she smoked and she drank all her life and she never got any cancer.
Okay. So, your point is that your grandmother smoked and drank all her life and she never got cancer? Indeed. Because she had that karma to live that long. I think it was Mark Twain or somebody, but he was asked the secret of his long life. He lived up to 90. He said, I smoked since I was 11, chain smoker. I drank since I was 13 or something, and I'm doing it to this day, and X, Y, Z, he went on giving that. So again, that's karma. Because the span of one's life is also determined according to certain karma performed in previous life. But if somebody is doing that, things like drinking and so on and so forth in this life, they will get the reactions to that karma in the future. It will come. So karma never goes, you know, it follows you like a shadow. Have you been in the sun and tried to get rid of your shadow? Not possible. So karma is like that. It just follows you. So now the question arises, what is the meaning of all this, this journey that we are undergoing? It seems so endless, so pointless, this whole thing. But there is a purpose. And the purpose is that we as spirit souls don't belong here. Because this world is a material world. And we are spiritual entities. So this is an incompatible combination. So we are meant to be in an atmosphere, in a world where everything is spiritual. And the Bhagavad Gita tells us that there is indeed such a world. A world beyond this world of our experience. Beyond where our telescopes and microscopes and instruments can reach. That world cannot be perceived by anything gross of this material world. It can only be received through the words of God in the scripture, through Bhagavad Gita. So just as we are eternal, so there is a world that is eternal. And the Lord of that world is Krishna, the all-attractive personality of Godhead. Can we have that other picture which has Radha and Krishna? Yes. So there you see Krishna, the blue god playing the flute. I mean, the idea of reincarnation, past life, previous life is strange enough. And then we talk of a god who is blue and who plays a flute. Come on, it's too much, isn't it? Seems so. But not really. Once we get into it, then it's really something out of this world, literally. So, in the spiritual world is Krishna, the all-attractive, all-beautiful, supreme Lord, supreme personality of Godhead. We have a relationship of love with Him. And out of forgetfulness of Him, we have been here in this material world, in our Disneyland, fantasy land. And then eventually we wake up and say, enough of this fantasy business. I can't be an enjoyer here. I am eternally linked in pure love to Krishna. I am part and parcel of Krishna. And only by loving Krishna can I be really happy. And then we start chanting Hare Krishna. We start learning Bhagavad Gita. We learn the philosophy. We implement the practice in our life. And gradually our consciousness starts evolving. And we've made the beginning of our exit from this material world. And then as we evolve, when we reach the pinnacle, the perfection of our spiritual consciousness, which we call Krishna consciousness, then we become eligible to go back to Krishna. Then when we die, our soul will be taken back to Krishna's kingdom, the eternal spiritual world. And we don't have to take birth again and go through all this cycle here and experience everything that we've done for millions and zillions of lives before. That is the perfection of life. And that is the end of one nightmarish journey. Our present journey is a nightmarish journey. Imagine driving on a cliff and your driver is intoxicated and he's also mad at somebody, he's angry at someone and he's really pushing on the pedal and you go boom, 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 you go around. It's a nightmare to be in that journey. So similarly, we've been through these different species, we've experienced death, we've experienced disaster, we've experienced pain, discomfort, a little bit of happiness too here and there, pleasure. But overall, it's been a nightmarish journey. So now we have to come out and wake up from this nightmare and realize that actually I'm woken up, I'm a spiritual being. I was asleep, my soul was asleep now. But now I've woken up and I've realized that I'm an eternal part and parcel of Krishna. And to love Him and go back to Krishna is the ultimate perfection of my life. So we chant, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, as the prime means of deliverance of the soul, as the prime means of disentangling the soul from this hard knot of material attachment, from this cycle of birth and death. And we can free ourselves once and for all and reach that sublime supreme abode of Krishna. How many of you want to go there? There are no taxes there, by the way. You don't need NHS. It's bliss. There's no old age, no disease, no death, no quarrel, only love, real love, not the love of this world. Real love, real happiness, eternity. Fun every day, 24/7, uninterrupted. Good deal? Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. We have 5 minutes of questions. Any more questions? Yes.
I'm sorry to ask this question. Maybe it has been asked many times and answered many times, but why do great devotees like Bhakti Tirtha Swami, for example, would get cancer? And of course, their death was an exemplary bhakti, but still.
Okay, your question is, why is it that sometimes great devotees get cancer? Or they die in ways that are not considered normal?
They have done so much more.
They could have done so much more, yes. The answer is that ultimately life and death are in the hands of Krishna. And when one has surrendered to Krishna, then Krishna takes charge of our life. And then it's up to Him as to where He wants to engage us in His service. In what capacity, on what plane, etc. So if He wishes us to leave prematurely, what we think is prematurely, that's His sublime arrangement. For reasons that we cannot fathom. And we see this indeed. Many great saints in history have departed from this world very early. They lived short lives. So it is not the number of years that we live that is important. What is important is the quality of our life rather than the number of years. If we have lived a life that is spiritually enlightened, that is Krishna conscious, and we have shared this with as many people as we can in the world, then our life is a life well lived. Otherwise, it's a life lived in vain. Just going through this, round and round and round. It's only thing is not a merry-go-round, it's misery-go-round. Okay, yes.
When we lived in an ashram with my friend, we were explained this karma as a selfish, selfless act, not to even expect that good karma coming to us.
Karma yoga.
When we did the karma yoga.
Mm-hmm. Yes, karma yoga is different from ordinary karma. You see, ordinary karma performed by anybody, any activity performed is called a karma. So that is the general definition of karma. But there are specific definitions of karma also. So when karma or activity is performed, first of all, activity that is from the fruits of that activity is karma yoga. So I act sincerely for the right thing, something that is not prohibited. But I do it sincerely, and whatever the result, I'm satisfied with it. If it's positive, I don't jump in joy. If it's negative, I don't collapse in moroseness. I'm equipoised. And I perform the activity out of a sense of duty.
So there is a little bit of difference between the karma yoga and karma as a general principle.
Yes. Karma as a general principle means people without any understanding of the law of karma, or of karma yoga, or of any spiritual activity, they just generally perform whatever act comes to their mind. Whatever their mind says, they succumb to the impulses of the mind. The mind orders one thing, they do it. The next moment the mind says something else, they do that. So they're generating karma in that broad sense of the word. But they have no idea of what yoga is. Yoga means to connect with God. But when these people perform activities, there is no connection to God, so we don't call it karma. But when you rise to a level of consciousness where you start thinking of your work as something divine, you think, I'm working for God, you work and then you detached. That is karma yoga. So you say the fruit is not mine. I work, but ultimately the fruit belongs to somebody else. But you don't know who's that somebody else. It's not mine. But then as you progress further, you realize actually it's meant for Krishna. Because Krishna has given me the body, he has given me the intelligence, he has given the ability, he has given me the circumstances in which I'm doing these activities. Therefore, I must offer it to him. So that's the highest stage of karma yoga. And then comes a point when we say, why should I just work and offer the fruits of my actions to Krishna? I should surrender to him and do everything for him directly. So there's no question of offering the fruits of our actions to Krishna. Our very actions are for Krishna. That's called bhakti yoga. So in this way, there are grades of elevation of consciousness. And then we come to this consciousness of surrendering to Krishna and doing everything for his pleasure. Then gradually our love for him develops. Then we reach the pinnacle of the achievement of bhakti yoga. We attain pure love of Godhead. That is the perfection of life. Okay?
Sorry, I don't want to take no one's time, but we are living in this materialistic world. We came from London, working hard, making money. Mm-hmm. We are yoga practitioners and teachers and whatever we are, but at the same time we are business people. Are we generating bad karma by these business crazy activities of London?
Are we generating bad karma by doing business in London? Not necessarily. It depends on what your business is.
Yeah.
If it's not a good business, yes.
It's yoga.
If it's yoga, it's pure. So there's no problem. And everyone has to have a livelihood. So if you're earning your livelihood from yoga, there's no problem in that. So your source of livelihood is pure, so there's no problem. Now comes the question of what you do with the money you earn. That is the question. Now you use it for Krishna, for moving ahead in your spiritual life. And don't use the money for anything which Krishna will not like, which is not good for your spiritual development, which will spoil your consciousness and take you away from spiritual life. then whether you live in London or you live anywhere else, it doesn't matter. Okay? All right. Thank you very much. I have to go to another lecture now, for another group like yours. So you've been a wonderful audience, and I thank you very much for your very patient and kind attention and your participation by asking so many good questions also. And I thank all of you who are organizing this. How many of you are the organizers? Raise your hand. They're humble, so they don't raise their hand. But still, don't be humble for a minute and just raise your hand. Okay, so my thanks to all of you for organizing such nice programs and giving everybody an opportunity to have a wonderful day like this. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.
As Maharaj shoots out the door for his next engagement downstairs, he's actually engaged in speaking for the next hour after this as well, I believe. But we just want to thank him on behalf of Kirtan London. I was really observing how Maharaj was very succinct. He didn't stutter at any point. Very clear in thought process. And I think the amazing thing about speakers, or a good speaker, is someone who can concisely and effectively get the point across in a simple way. Make something really big, really simple. And he did that for us tonight. So thank you so much. We give him another round of applause. We hope to see you again soon. Another Kirtan London event.
I hope so too.
Wonderful. So our next engagement now is going to be Jinnah.